on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. And as alluded to earlier, we have got a very special guest on the line. I'm very grateful for this person's time this afternoon, because he is literally an expert in, frankly, anything and everything, really, in my opinion, when it comes to planetary discussions and, of course, space and anything in between. So good afternoon to you, Dr. David Whitehouse.
Good afternoon.
Pleasure to have you here today. And thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us here on Vectis Radio.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the nice intro.
Thank you. Well, it's very true. I mean, I'm very fascinated, and I've been looking forward to this discussion with you this afternoon, because, of course, a lot of people are talking about it at the moment, and this is being dubbed this century's longest blood moon, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. It's an eclipse of the moon, when the moon passes into the Earth's shadow. And the moon can either pass directly into the Earth's shadow, or it can go off to one side. But tonight, it's going to go straight through the middle of the deepest part of the Earth's shadow. So lunar eclipses don't get much longer than this. It's going to last, in all, about an hour and three quarters. But we won't see all of that, because the moon will be rising this evening from our part of the world, already eclipsed. So you best catch the moon around about 7 o'clock and just watch the moon rise. And then the eclipse will play out before you.
Excellent. So 7 o'clock this evening is the best time to go out and have a look at this.
Well, that's the start of it. Go out and find the moon as it rises. And then for the next hour and a half or so, you will see the moon darken. It'll already be dark because it's in the outer part of the eclipse. Then it may well turn blood red. And this is a fairly rare phenomenon. It occurs because the only light reaching the moon when it's deep in the Earth's shadow comes from light that's refracted around the edge of the Earth, a thin atmosphere, acts like a prism, and refracts red light towards the moon. And this is a nice curiosity, like a rainbow or a waterfall or something. But to the ancients, it was highly significant. It was an important time, and they used to celebrate blood moons as being vital, in fact, to their survival.
Incredible, yeah. So really, in a way, then, the fascination of lunar eclipses as a general rule back in the day, as you could say, of course, hundreds of years ago, was really from a superstitious point of view then, to begin with.
That's right. We now know it's the clockwork of nature, and it's a wonderful spectacle to see, and we should all, if you get time, go and look at it. But to the ancients, who lived in a very different world, a world dominated by the rhythms of the sky, the rhythms of the seasons, they regarded the moon as being very important. In the Middle East, for instance, the moon was regarded as the giver of fertility to the earth, and that's because of the coincidence in the length of the month, which comes from moon, and the female fertility cycle. So when the moon turned blood red in a total lunar eclipse, that was regarded to them as being a highly significant time when the moon, if you like, gave the earth a gift of fertility. And they all banged their drums and went out to celebrate this, because they didn't know what we know about our environment. So they attributed these things, lunar eclipses, solar eclipses, comets, etc., as being messages from heaven. And this was one of the good messages you had to celebrate.
Incredible. Very interesting there, David. Now, I do want to sort of delve a little bit deeper, sort of in terms of the moon, and I suppose this is probably one of the most commonly asked questions, and I don't know if this is sort of something you would necessarily be able to answer, but how is sort of the moon here? Because, I mean, of course, it didn't just appear out of nowhere. So how, what sort of do we know so far about the history of the moon?
Well, we've known, there have been various theories as to where the moon came from. One in the past was that it was a planet that formed next to us. Another is that it was something that was formed in our solar system when the Earth was formed and we captured it. And another outlandish theory suggests that when the Earth was very young, it was spinning rapidly and it's a drop that plopped off the Earth. But we really got our best clue from the Apollo astronauts when they brought back moon rocks. Because in some senses, moon rocks were very identical to Earth rocks. And unlike any other rock we know from elsewhere in the solar system, meteors, for example. And scientists wondered why that was. And we now think that 4.5 billion years ago, when the solar system was young and there were lots more bodies orbiting the sun, that the early Earth Mark I was a bit bigger than our planet, and it was hit by an object the size of Mars. And there was an almighty explosion, and the debris which was left orbiting the early Earth very quickly coalesced into a single body. And that's the moon, and that's why some people call the moon the eighth continent, or a piece of the Earth splashed up into the sky.
Incredible.
We have a bit of the Mars object that hit us. The moon is mostly made of rocks that were once material that was once on the Earth Mark I. So it's a bit of the Earth, really.
Incredible. So would that also explain then why, of course, it's not been as prominent as recently as Mars, since I think we've discovered more and more about Mars. Perhaps the moon has sort of lost a bit of attention, but that would explain then perhaps why, up until recently, perhaps people were talking about life on the moon.
Well, the moon, of course, is an airless globe. It was never big enough to hold on to any atmosphere, and because it's much smaller than the Earth and Mars, it cooled very, very quickly and died rapidly. Mars, of course, is a new world. Mars has the land area of the land area of Earth, because Mars doesn't have any oceans. And it's a true world with mountains, atmosphere, canyons, mountain ranges, and mist that clears from canyons at dawn. It's a wonderful new world. It's not, if you like, a dead world like the moon. But there have been some suggestions recently that when the moon was young, it might have held onto an atmosphere temporarily, and it might have cooled enough so there could have been liquid water on its surface for a while. And we know that life on the Earth started very quickly. Almost as soon as the conditions were nearly right, life began to start. So it's possible it started on the moon. It's a hypothesis. It's possible it started on Mars as well, because billions of years ago, the Earth and the Mars were very similar. But like the moon, Mars was small, and it lost its atmosphere, and it lost its protection against solar radiation and the solar wind, and it froze. So Mars's life is probably in the past. Of course, the Earth's life is today, and the moon's life, if it was there at all, it was probably very transient.
Interesting. So that would, of course, explain then why, as you said very correctly, I think, at the beginning of the interview, that, of course, the moon is sort of, and you, it's a very good word to use, sort of the debris now, debris of the Earth. Because, of course, as you say, it's perhaps, as you've just mentioned there and highlighted, that Mars is more sort of lifelike. It's more, at the least, it's more likely to have life and signs of life than the moon. So that you've put it in a really great sort of nutshell there, really, Dr. David Whitehouse, in the sense where you've sort of explained that Mars, if I'm getting the gist, that is, that Mars is probably more where we should be looking at, because it sort of has similar tendencies to Earth at the moment.
Well, yes, we should look preferentially to Mars, and perhaps a few other places in the solar system to look for life. But the problem with Mars is that it's so far away. I mean, it takes a few days to get to the moon. It takes a year to get to Mars. So if we're talking about exploring the solar system, even though there are some astronauts who will say, at the moon, we've been there and done that, I think we really have to go back to the moon first and learn how to live in space, establish a colony on the moon, before we then go out to Mars and perhaps send people there to search for life. So both have their places and different roles in our exploring the cosmos. And of course, the moon and Mars have great significance in the past in terms of their influence on our civilization and on ancient peoples.
Fascinating. I mean, it would be incredible, wouldn't it, if there were humans, as you said, colonies, on the moon. And I mean, it would just be fascinating. I mean, in sort of all realisticness, as to coin a phrase, would you sort of put a prediction out there? I mean, do you think that it's actually possible? Because we can't sort of even consider it at the moment as humans, I don't think. I think we find, with everything in the news at the moment, we find life hard enough on Earth. I mean, is there actually a real prospect of this happening, do you think?
Well, since the first Apollo landing on the moon 49 years ago this week, we haven't gone back after Apollo 70 in 1972. And a lot of people wanted to go back, but somehow the political will, the funding, the determination hasn't been there. We could go back. We could have gone back. We could have had a colony on the moon by now. I think that there is a renewed interest in the moon and using the moon's space as a sort of gateway to the solar system. But looking at the latest plans from Russia, from the United States, I don't think you're going to see a person on the moon now till the latter half of the next decade. It was hoped that it would have been in a couple of years' time. Under President Bush, it would have been 2019, next year. Under programs more recently, it would have been the early 20s, but now it seems to have slipped. So back on the moon, 10 years' time, on Mars, 5 or 10 years after that. And you know what that means? That means the first person to step on Mars is already alive.
Incredible.
And it's already going to school somewhere, perhaps. Who knows where they are? But they're alive and they're amongst us. We just don't know who they are, obviously.
That really does put it into perspective, doesn't it? And who knows, of course, we could have, as you say, someone who is in a classroom. I know they're not in classrooms now because, obviously, school's broken out, but...
Could be in the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and who knows? It could be that there could be the next Tim Peake in this country, perhaps even on the Isle of Wight, who will go to Mars. I mean, that would be incredible, wouldn't it?
That's stuff of history, yes.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much for your time, David, because you're, I mean, as I say, I really appreciate your time this afternoon because you really are, and this is no exaggeration, an expert in this topic, and it's been great to watch you. I mean, like anything of this topic and magnitude of discussion, I could just sit here for 3 hours and talk to you and not play any music. But of course, if people want to find out a little bit more about what you do, you have got a Twitter page, haven't you? And you've got a couple of books, a new one you've released called Journey to the Centre of the Earth. Did you want to just sort of quickly let our listeners know about that?
I've got a website, davidwhitehouse.com, and you can find my Twitter handle from that. Yes, I've written 5 books, and 2 more are on the way. And I always wanted to write a book about the moon, and I was an astronomer and a journalist for many years. But I always wanted to write this moon book, and it was the first book I wrote, and I was fascinated to pull together the story of the mythology, the science, the art, the culture of the moon, to put it together. And I really enjoyed that, and people have said they like the book, so that's very pleasing. And a couple of years back I was looking for a different kind of book, and I noticed that it was the 150th anniversary of Jules Verne's classic Journey to the Centre of the Earth, and I thought, well, let's write that, but let's write a scientific version. So that's a fascinating book to write. You start at the crust of the Earth, and you take a journey to the core with a few diversions in between. And, of course, I had a great title, which was nice. Journey to the Centre of the Earth.
Absolutely, and that always helps. And if it's anything like this interview that we've had, I'm sure it is succinct and cut straight down the middle of it without sort of confusing our listeners, because that's what I find absolutely great about listening to you, talking to you, you know, reading the work you've done. What you do is you manage to just make it understandable to the everyday person, which is a real art in itself, Dr. David Whitehouse. So,
well, you're very kind. Thank you.
Oh, no worries. Well, hopefully we'll have you on the show again soon. It'd be great to, you know, talk and catch up. And thank you very much for your time this afternoon, David.
You're very welcome, and I hope you enjoy the clips tonight.
Thank you. I will do. I will certainly be watching it.